This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where a portion of this interview will appear in print. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 59th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I am super pleased to have with me today Ralph Langner. Hi, Ralph.
Hi, Gary.
Ralph Langner is the founder and CEO of Langner Communications, a German company focused on control system security. Ralph has over 20 years of experience working with computerized control systems. His foray into security came about as a direct result of his work on the Stuxnet worm. Ralph was the first researcher to determine that Stuxnet is a directed cyber warfare attack against Iran. Ralph lives in Hamburg, Germany. Thanks for joining us today, Ralph.
Thank you, Gary.
So I met you at originally at Joe Weiss's ACS Control System Cybersecurity Conference, which is a mouthful, in Maryland, where it seemed like I was one of the few security guys surrounded by a whole bunch of control systems people.
That's correct.
And so my question to you is, just how little do most control systems people know about cybersecurity anyway?
Well, I think there are a bunch of control system experts who really know a lot of IT security. But unfortunately, it's way too few. So the problem that we have is that the engineers in the field are not experienced as we would like to see it. Mm-hmm. And there is one very simple reason for this fact. They just don't have the time and the budget. So in most operations, the understanding is that control systems are actually more a matter of electricians rather than IT. Mm-hmm. Certainly, this is no longer true for many years now, but things take long to change culture. So when you enter the average plant floor, you will probably see very, very few engineers who have actually any experience in IT security, and definitely this has to change, especially after the Stuxnet experience.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that. I will say this, though, the quality of the engineers themselves was extremely high. So the people at Joe's group especially were very, very good engineers and very good systems engineers. The issue was just one of exposure to the whole notion of cybersecurity. You know, there's sort of an important philosophical difference, I think, between trying to prepare for some sort of a reliability issue that may involve, say, random sunspot activity, and trying to prepare for intentionally malicious activity that an informed adversary might bring at you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. Well, that's correct. And actually, you were looking at let's say, an in-group. So many of the fellows that you met at your WISE conference are hanging around at those conferences year after year. And as I said, this has to spread. But I would like to point out one other very important issue. So one problem that we have is that, as a matter of fact, you just can't apply proven concepts from IT security to the planned fraud.
Unfortunately, I totally agree.
That doesn't work. So if you look at our problems in detail, you will find so many differences to IT security. So just to give you an example here, mm-hmm. you look at the average controller and you don't find any authentication, authorization. There is no antivirus software on that controller. It can't, because it's basically a single-tasking real-time system. Mm-hmm. There is no hard disk on it. There is no patch management. So we don't have all these. And one funny difference is that most of our vulnerabilities are, in fact, not bugs, as you know it from the IT world, that the vendor simply has a flaw in his software that can be exploited. The vulnerabilities that we are concerned with most, they're actually product features, legitimate product features.
Yep, they get turned on their head, yep.
Yeah, and this leads us to a very difficult problem, because these vulnerabilities just can't be patched away overnight,
yep.
because this will lead to version conflicts. So many of our most nasty vulnerabilities will stay for us for several more years.
So I'm in total agreement with that, and I think most of the listeners to this podcast are as well, because our focus here is much more in line with security engineering and software security, designing and building things properly, than it is with this sort of, antivirus firewall approach to IT security, which has failed us, frankly. So, yeah. I think we're in the same boat, and Stuxnet is actually kind of useful in getting people to understand the nature of the problem, possibly for the first time, even in the IT security domain.
I agree. Yeah,
your conversation at Joe's, your presentation at Joe's thing was great, and I wanted to ask you, what got you started analyzing the Stuxnet code in the first place?
Well, that was actually quite easy. As anybody associated with security, certainly we also heard about Stuxnet in last summer. And at first, what we heard, we didn't take it quite serious, to be absolutely honest, because there are so many aspects that just didn't make sense. So,
yep.
for example, when it was speculated that the vulnerability for the SCADA database could probably be used by Stuxnet to exfiltrate intellectual property, that just didn't make sense. Because, I mean, if you're familiar with the SCADA database, what you find in there, that's our raw data.
Yeah, so it's not very interesting, is it?
Yeah, absolutely. So even if there was the Coke recipe in it, you just wouldn't find it. So this didn't make sense. But at some point in time around August, it got clear that this thing was much more complex than anybody thought, and it also got clear that it tried to do something with controllers, and that was the turning point for us when we began to take Stuxnet serious, because controllers is all we do, so we don't bother with Windows PCs when it comes to security. I have always lived by the motto, hackers, crackers, creeps, scum of the universe. You can do anything you want with Windows PCs, but don't step foot onto controllers, because that's our domain.
Oh, it's too late now, man.
So when that got clear, we downloaded a copy of Stuxnet, infected our lab environment, and started the analysis. And certainly I have to add that we have the luxury that we have all the equipment in place that you need to actually do this type of analysis. So we have the Siemens controllers, we have the Siemens software, that's also very important. And certainly, and most important, we also have the know-how. So as you said in the introduction, we are in this field for 20 years, and so we know this stuff very well. And we were able to spot in the Wireshark traces, for example, what actually was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing surprised us at that point, because as a matter of fact, we could see Stuxnet talking to controllers the very first day,
right.
which seemed kind of odd to me, because I thought it must have been much more stealthy. Otherwise, other stakeholders in the research, such as the vendor in question, would certainly have been able to tell us more about what the thing is doing previously. But so anyway, we got results very quickly, and these results still were a little bit puzzling, because it just did not do what we expected. At first, we expected that once we had infected our lab environment, that we had given Stuxnet something to eat. So we threw very nice Siemens controllers at the beast.
Mm-hmm.
It just didn't want to eat.
Right.
And
took a while to figure out what it liked.
Yeah, absolutely. That was absolutely amazing, because we saw, no, it doesn't eat, but it's sniffing. It's just checking out the target, and obviously it just didn't like the target.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the first clues that we realized, well, this is a directed attack. because this thing was looking for something very specific. And then by going into the debugger and configuring the PLCs in a certain manner that Stuxnet seemed to like, we were able to get more and more information. And as it turned out, it was, as I said, 100% directed. It was not even only looking for a specific controller type. In the end, it is even checking if the target configuration that would drive the centrifuge in Natanz is actually loaded on these controllers.
Yeah, I want to get into that in a minute. But before we get there, okay. I wanted to ask you something kind of leading towards that the depth of the payload. So in the beginning, there were companies that were your typical antivirus companies like F-Secure and Symantec. Mm-hmm. And they were all over the delivery mechanism. They were all wound around the axle about the 4-0 days and the private crypto keys and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. How long did it take before those guys realized there even was a payload and not even a Siemens payload, just any payload at all? Did they ever figure that out?
My understanding is that they did figure that out after a couple of months. Mm-hmm. And even if they only figured it out by doing the math, by determining, well, this is...
Yeah, there's some code here that we don't understand, right?
Yeah, we don't understand it, but there must be a hidden reason for this. My understanding is that at some point in time, many of them even identified the rogue DLL that's essential for infecting the controllers, but they just couldn't make sense out of it.
Right. Well, I mean, you got to know step 7 code, I suppose.
Yeah.
So have you been working with the Siemens guys to understand the payload, or is this mostly been your own lab working on that?
Well, this is completely our own research here. We are completely independent. This research has not been funded by anybody. Mm-hmm. And there have been very, very brief interactions with Siemens. The only request that Siemens had to us in respect to a potential cooperation was at WiseCon when one of their Stuxnet guys contacted me, and we just chatted very briefly. And he was asking,
yeah, that was Tomas, I suppose.
If we would be interested in cooperating after the conference, I said certainly yes, but they never followed up on the offer.
So I understand from seeing some presentations that the Siemens guys have done, and also from your work, that a typical configuration, especially in pipelines, but also in centrifuge arrays, it turns out, is to have a 417 control a whole bunch of 315s. And
that's the attack configuration.
Yeah, and the 417 attack code, in my view, is the most interesting. So maybe you can take a few minutes to explain the DLL interpositioning that gets to the controller, and then the modification of OB1 and OB35.
Yeah, sure. So first of all, the DLL that is hijacked by Stuxnet, that's the link to get on the controllers. Again, the controllers, they are not computers. They are not PCs. They are small gray boxes, embedded real-time systems, no hard disk, no keyboard, no screen attached. Mm-hmm. They're just standalone. And mm-hmm. these systems are programmed actually on a PC, usually on a notebook system, mm-hmm. and the program, which we usually call ladder logic, that the engineer has developed, is then loaded onto the controller. Might be via Ethernet, might also be via a proprietary Siemens connection, which is called MPI, or via profile bus, that's a field bus link. And in order to access any of these three media, the Siemens products use one driver DLL. Mm-hmm. And this has been hijacked by Stuxnet in a way so that Stuxnet is able in a man-in-the-middle attack to insert its own code in the blocks that is loaded on the PLC by the engineer.
I thought it was kind of funny that DLL, the one that was interposed by Stuxnet, was actually slightly better protected from a security perspective since it had the symbol table stripped. and the original Siemens DLL didn't.
That's correct, yeah.
that's pretty funny.
That surprised me a lot to see when we were debugging the code. Well, oh, they have the symbolic information in it, so the Siemens guys. So. Yeah. I certainly did not expect that. But just to stay on here on this topic for just one second, there is an interesting point with that original Siemens DLL. Even though the symbolic information still is in it, what the average attacker would not know is all the calling convention.
Exactly.
And this is... This is very, very difficult to reverse engineer. So this is one of the items of evidence that I see that the attackers must have in any way insider knowledge of Siemens products. So there are several other areas where we see such a high level of intimate knowledge with the Siemens architecture and product that this cannot reasonably just have been re-engineered by, let's say, your most skilled hacker within a reasonable amount of time, let's say 1 or 2 years. This just isn't possible.
Just takes more expertise than that.
Yeah. So we ended up with a hijacked legitimate driver DLL. The code goes on the controller and loads a lot of stuff on the controller. And in a sense, this is a stealth control system that is now running concurrently with the legitimate code. Mm-hmm. So the legitimate code is still on the controller and it is executed. But there is this stealthy part, the rogue part, that monitors operation of the IOs.
I think this is really, really important. That's what makes it kind of like a rootkit for the controller. And it's also important to understand, I think, that the payload itself makes use of that original controller code that's sitting around.
Well, actually, I don't like the term rootkit in relation to controllers because the architecture of these controllers is so different from what you see on a PC or on, let's say, on a Linux box that the term really does not apply very well. So we do have some stealthiness here. We do have some advanced attack technology, but it's really quite different from what we know and see in the IT world.
Here's why I think it's like a rootkit, even though I'm fine with not using that term. The notion is standing in front of an IO stream, so you get the control call or a query, say, what's in that register, and you control what you say about what's in that register and are thus able to hide from simple queries that are looking for the infection.
Mm. Yeah. Well, that's correct. So it's in a certain part, it is quite stealthy. On the other hand, I would like to point out that in certain other parts, it's not stealthy at all.
Right.
For example, just to hijack this DLL and renaming the original DLL, well, you do that only once. After Stuxnet, I think this technology will not work thereafter because it's just too easy.
Yep.
Yeah, and there are certain other things that apply to the controller attack too. So, for example, you just have to use a version control system for controllers that does not use the infected vendor's driver, mm-hmm. and you would see the changes immediately. So it's just as long as you stay in that basic average engineering environment that the attack would remain stealthy. So it's in this respect, it's really not rocket science.
Right,
it's much more basic than your average Windows rootkit that you see today, and even what the Stuxnet parts that make up the rootkit on the Windows system.
Yeah.
So that's really in many respects very, very different.
That's very interesting, you know, because since it's sort of a target that hasn't been hit before, it hasn't been hardened at all, and it's susceptible to pretty basic attacks.
Yes, that's absolutely right, Gary. And I would like to point out one thing that I have heard several complaints about Stuxnet in parenthesis. So that I have heard that hackers told the public, yeah, Stuxnet, this is so shitty code, and we could have done it so much better. The fact of the matter is it was not needed to do it any better.
Exactly.
Because the attackers had the advantage of surprise.
And they knew about the Siemens systems, and these hacker boys, they just don't. I mean, it's that simple.
That's correct. So certainly there are several areas where Stuxnet can be improved. We think it will be improved for the version 2.0. but it just wasn't needed. It wasn't required. So it worked pretty well.
Can you explain
nobody expected it.
Can you explain the payload in a little bit more detail and get into the OB1 and the OB35
modifications? Yeah, sure. Yeah, certainly. So as I said, the Rogue ELL infects the controllers. It injects what I call a stealth controller system that runs in parallel with the legitimate code. And the important point here for the attack is that you must this additional rogue code getting called. And as a matter of fact, what you see in Stuxnet is this is actually very, very easy. Because all that you need to do is to insert calls to your rogue code at the beginning of these two code blocks that you mentioned. One is OB1 and the other is OB35. OB1 is in the Siemens world is the main routine that is called every time you start up the controller. So it would be for C programmers your main function.
Yep.
And the difference to a C program is that this function is called in a loop. So it's called over and over again,
right.
Many, many, many times per second. And once that you manage to get at the beginning of OB1 or any other code block, then you're in business.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what Stuxnet does. It just inserts function calls at the beginning of this code block.
Yep.
And depending on the return codes of these functions that Stuxnet calls, it decides whether to pass control along to the legitimate code or not.
Right.
So this is basically how it works on the smaller controllers on the 315.
Yep.
The other code block that you mentioned, that's OB35, that's a 100 millisecond timer that you find in every Siemens S7 PLC. This is just, let's say, an interrupt handler or an event handler that's called automatically by the operating system of the controller 10 times per second.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is another opportunity that has been exploited by the attackers. Once that you insert your rogue code there, again at the beginning of the block, your rogue code will be called 10 times per second.
Mm-hmm.
So that's actually quite straightforward. And the problem here is how easy it is in technical terms to actually do that, to make that happen.
Mm.
So for example, there is no check-in. So the controller does not do any checks if this is really authentic and if code integrity isn't violated.
Right, it just
all
does
this
it.
Isn't done.
Yep.
So you just insert your rogue code in that man-in-the-middle scenario into the code for the legitimate OB1, and you're in business. And this is a big, big problem for us because it actually works on any Siemens S7 around the world, and
right.
There are several millions of these controllers.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. You know, how many Siemens control installations are vulnerable to similar attacks? So you say thousands.
Yeah.
Yep.
No, millions.
Millions. Okay,
actually,
that's interesting. Because of the OB1 interpositioning. And
exactly.
Just to make this clear, you know, a lot of people are familiar with writing graphical user interface code, or at least some sort of a event handler that does user interface stuff. And this is kind of like the rendering thing, like render world in the WoW code. You know, the notion is you flush the buffers, that runs once every, you know, few clicks regardless. So it's the control loop that you're getting into.
Yes, that's correct. So that's the basic attack routine or attack technology. And this is a very big problem for us because it works with every Siemens controller. And you also find these controllers, let's say, in power plants, in chemical plants, in food and beverage companies. Mm-hmm. So they are not application specific. They are not only used in uranium enrichment facilities.
Right. I suppose, beyond the OB-1 and the OB-35, what would you call them? The OB-1 and OB-35 branch code, there are frequency converter attacks in there, right? That go even further than just those, that get down into the specifics of how the NANTAS centrifuge facility works.
Gary, the important distinction here is that what Stuxnet does against the frequency converters, that is application specific.
Yes.
The thing with the code injections into OB-1 is not. That's generic.
Excellent.
And
yep.
That's our problem.
Super.
Because it works with any application.
Yep.
The manipulations that Stuxnet does with the frequency converters, they will only work with these specific models and with this specific installation.
Yep.
So,
well, I remember there was even a thing about querying how many 315s were attached to a 417. It was something between 31 and 2,000. It had to be a specific number.
That's a little bit different. So the attack code actually queries how many frequency converters are attached to the 315. The thing with the 417, that's a different story.
Gotcha, thanks.
But to remain with the 315 just for a second here, there is another very nasty generic attack technology, and that is overwriting a system function of the operating system or a library function. Mm-hmm. That would be similar, like, let's say, again, when thinking about C programming, I always have to use this example because that's the last programming language I used in IT. This would be something like overriding your printf function call.
Mm-hmm.
So every time you call printf in your application, well, it does print something, but it does something in addition that you don't recognize. And this is another attack technology that we see on the 315. The code overrides the system function call for reading values from the peripherals, mm-hmm. in this case the frequency converters, and so it gets an understanding of how much of these frequency converters are attached, how fast they are running, et cetera,
yep.
Again, this is generic, and this is the second of our problems, because this attack would also work, let's say, with valves, with pumps, et cetera.
Right.
It's not tied to a specific application. So these are
right.
the basic two attack techniques that we see on the 315.
So could you change that sort of 1 kilohertz filter into whatever value you wanted it to be?
Yeah, for example, actually Stuxnet doesn't do that. But again, the funny thing here is that it tells us a lot of the background of the attackers, because there were very few people around who even knew that this would be possible.
Right.
So when you program controllers, you would just take the system functions for granted. You would never think about touching the system function.
Exactly.
And what happens here is the attackers knew, well, they can be overwritten, and the program would still work. And this again tells us something about the deep level of knowledge that we are looking at.
Yeah, very good. We'll be right back after this message. If you like what you're hearing on Silver Bullet, you might check out my monthly security column on InformIT. I've collected all the columns I've written over the last 5 years on my website at sigital.com/GEM, or you can do a quick search under security at InformIT. Thanks for listening. So it seems really obvious to me that NANTAS, the Iranian centrifuge facility, is the real target, and maybe Bushehr too. But in the beginning, most of the coverage was about Bushir and nothing about name
tags.
Yeah,
that's my fault.
Thanks a lot, Ralph.
This is actually quite easy to explain. So first of all, Bushir is not Stuxnet's target.
Right.
That's 100% certain right now, because we have been able to link the data structures that we have in the code mm-hmm. to the actual plant layout in the TANs.
Yep,
That was very important. We discovered that, in late September. I guess it was December 27th.
Yeah, it seemed obvious to me, at least, even in Maryland. And it was surprising to me that the Symantec guys were still talking about the delivery mechanism and not the payload.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know.
Yes. Well, but I mean, they are, as they confess, they are not control system experts. And if you really want to determine what the target is, you can't remain in the code analysis. So you got to establish links to the outside world.
Right.
And in order to do that, you must be able to examine. So, for example, how centrifuges work, how a power plant works. And my fault was back in September, that when I made the connection to the Iranian nuclear program, that I identified Bushir as the most likely target.
Just because
this
it's a nuclear
wrong,
power
as,
plant,
as you know
right.
now.
Right.
But it was just from my basic layman's understanding of what significant strategic targets were. So, for example, I knew that Israel had attacked the nuclear power plant in Iraq before mm-hmm. they had attacked the nuclear power plant in Syria. So, for me, it looked like a natural target.
Right.
And then what contributed to that theory was that everything we researched about the control systems in a nuclear power plant, especially in Bushir, contributed to that theory.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
That was kind of strange that we actually had been able to nail down that the Siemens 417 controller is actually used in Bushir.
Right.
So that kept us on the wrong path.
Uh-huh.
And the major breakthrough came, as I said, on December 27th, when I realized how a centrifuge cascade is structured.
Right.
And then we did some additional background research and got a fairly good understanding of that organization, and the funny thing was, yeah, that's a 100% match to the code.
Yeah,
and the data structure is in the code.
I guess for those people who are not so familiar with Siemens systems, 417s are expensive, and they're usually not very many of them. But 315s, especially the 315-2s, are really cheap, and there tend to be lots of those.
Yeah, that's correct. So the 417, that's the top of the line model of the Siemens controllers, and you don't need that to run a cookie plant, for example. So this is used for big stuff and for complex plants. And one thing is very, very important here for the whole scenario, that from what we understand is that the 417 is especially used for safety purposes
right.
in NATANs.
Right.
And the big difference with your basic production system and a safety system is that while the production system, like the 315 controllers, is there, so for example, to produce uranium, the safety system is in place to make sure that the whole joint that doesn't blow up.
Yeah,
doesn't spin itself
out of control or whatever.
Yeah,
I think the same
exactly.
design is used in pipeline controllers.
Yeah, you know. For example, that's the same design that you would also find in a chemical plant, for
yep.
example,
yep.
When you must make sure that certain thresholds in terms of pressure or temperature, for example, are not exceeded. And one thing is very, very important here, because there are several misconceptions about the safety issue. It's not about fooling operators sitting in a control room.
Mm-hmm.
So this has been reported several times, but what we see in Stuxnet is much worse. The Stuxnet attack on the 417 actually fools the automated safety system.
Right.
So usually in safety you have several different layers, And the most important layers are the automated layers on at your front line.
Yeah, the watchdogs.
So your operator. Yeah. Yeah, the operator is actually the last line of defense.
Right.
But the front lines are very, very important because this is the stuff where, let's say, you must react within a second or a split second.
Right, it happens at superhuman speed, so you have to have the controller notice. Yep.
Absolutely, and you could also assume that the operator in the control room just fell asleep or he is out there taking a leak. And so you're laughing, but I mean, this is how it goes in real life.
No,
so,
I totally understand that. I'm laughing because it's true.
Yeah, but for any installation where really bad things can happen, you're definitely interested in having a good automated safety system.
So I want to...
And this is...
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I wanted to shift gears a little bit and talk about some of the meta aspects of this work as well, because we've already gone way over time, but it's been very, very interesting. So you've garnered a ton of press for this work, and I wanted to ask you two quick questions. What's the best coverage so far in your view, and who wrote the silliest, most ridiculous thing?
Okay, so one of the best pieces was certainly done by the New York Times.
Uh-huh.
And I would like to add one thing here. You cannot imagine the effort that the New York Times team has put into that short story.
Oh, I know those guys
are
great. They're great. I've worked with them in the past. So
yeah, and I have heard many complaints. Yeah, they're not telling any facts and evidence, et cetera, et cetera. I can tell, as one of their prime sources, there are many, many pieces of evidence that they did not tell.
Yeah.
I think they will at some point in time. There is obviously some additional research going on, reporting going on.
Yep.
But that was really, in my term, that was one of the highlights. And for the worst articles, well, I don't want to blame anybody.
Oh,
here.
Come
I
on.
Just, no. Just don't try to get me on that. I have just learned one thing, that there is such a huge difference between good and bad journalism.
Yeah.
But I would like to point out that, and I mean that very seriously, that the media really in total did an outstanding job.
Hmm.
And I would like to point that out for a specific reason, because there are other organizations who actually are obliged to inform you and everybody what Stuxnet is all about.
And they didn't do it.
They paid for it with taxpayers' money.
Right.
And they don't do it.
Well, they don't understand it. Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't say so. So, for example, if you look at DHS, they certainly have the experts. They have the resources. They have much more resources than we have. But they don't tell you what Stuxnet is all about. They don't deliver any research results. And
you're giving them more credit for understanding cybersecurity than I think they actually have, frankly.
Well, I can tell you one thing in respect to control system security. I know their resources, and
yeah.
I know they are definitely
much
bigger than ours.
Right.
So I was actually very, very pleased with several journalists. There is more stuff that's coming out, and I'm very, very happy that we have so many good people working there and informing the public what Stuxnet is all about.
Well, you know what? Frankly, also, Ralph, to your credit, it's very important that you covered this the way that you did, because there were so few people with technical expertise in control systems that were involved in the early days. This story could have spun off into yet another stupid virus, you know, zero day, blah, 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 all the usual people banging the usual drums about cybersecurity and never even getting to the control systems part. So thanks for that. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
So one last question. What do you think we should do to educate control systems engineers about security?
Well, the problem is we have to do a lot, and we have to start quick. And there are so many things where we could start. That's not the issue. The major point is to get things started and to get the budget, to get the funding for this. Mm-hmm. And if you talk to the average control system engineer, you're running in open doors. Mm-hmm. These guys understand the problem. What we have to do is we have to convince the CEOs. They haven't got it so far because they only understand, well, this is going to cost a lot of money, and well, we haven't seen much control system security incidents before.
Right. Well, I mean, even the Siemens guys are that way. I mean, they're barely started with their software security program, and I've been talking to them about it for more than a year now.
Yeah, absolutely. And so this is my point of view, what we should aim at. This is the CEOs that we need to target. You don't need to convince the engineers that they got the message, but right. They don't have the budget, they don't have the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds like a standard problem in computer security risks for sure. Now, a last question that has nothing to do with Stuxnet at all. What is your favorite piece of recent music?
My favorite piece of recent music. Oh, you know, I'm an old guy, so I don't listen to the top of the pops. But one of my favorite records is from Mark Anthony, Valle La Peña. So I like salsa, I like Latin music, I like Mark Anthony very much.
Super. Thanks, Ralph. This has been really interesting.
Okay. Thank you, Gary.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Inform IT. The January-February issue of IEEE Security and Privacy features the engineering of secure systems, as well as an interview with Paul Kotcher. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.